We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus. And today, I mean, I say this like every week because I know that there's somebody watching in person or someone watching online for the first time, and I don't want you to not know what's happening, so I repeat this a lot. But we began back in December of last year walking through the life of Jesus. We started with a Christmas story, obviously, the birth of Jesus, and we are continuing still now. We got a long ways to go. There's a lot to tell about that. Today, we're going to look at a pretty intense encounter. Before we do, I want to just remind you of last week's story. Last week, we saw Jesus calm two storms on the Sea of Galilee when his disciples were in trouble in their boats. And of course, we know the Sea of Galilee is actually a very large lake, which if you live in this region, you know all about large lakes, right? It's a large lake. And on the lake, they had two storms come through two different times. The first time, Jesus was on the boat with them, but he was asleep, and they woke him up to help them. The other time, he was not with them, but he came. He watched them from a distance. He came walking through the storm on the water and did the miracle there. And we saw those two separate stories last Sunday. I bring that up because today's story takes place immediately after that first story. Right after Jesus was wakened on the boat, he said, "Peace, be still," and calmed the storm. And they were all shocked. After that story takes place is this story today. And this story is found in Matthew and Mark and in Luke, but we're going to follow along just in Mark because Mark gives us great detail for our edification. So let's jump into Mark chapter 5 and beginning with verse number 1. It says, "So they arrived at the other side of the lake in the region of the Gerasenes." So this is where they are now. It says that when Jesus climbed out of the boat, a man possessed by an evil spirit came out from the tombs to meet him. Now, I won't get into this at length. We've mentioned it before, and we'll discuss it in great detail one day, I'm sure. But Jesus seemed to be a magnet. The presence of God in a bod, the presence of God in our world is in human form, just to bring that spiritual, physical presence into our dimensions, so to speak, seemed to awaken a heightened sense and connection point with demonic activity. Probably it was a magnet of some sorts that you see a lot in his story for reasons that I would guess deal with the fact that he was here. But either way, here's another story where Jesus is getting off the boat. By the way, imagine getting off the boat. You're the disciples. Like, you just got through a storm. You thought you were going to die in the storm, you know. You're scared out of your minds, and then all of a sudden, Jesus calms the storm, and you're thinking, "Oh, good, we're not going to die today." Then you land on the shore next to a bunch of tombstones. That's what's exciting, you know. Oh, good. That's right where I want to be right now. How could it get worse? Oh, here's how it could get worse. Here comes a man out of the tombstones who is demonically possessed. This is a great day. But this man comes charging out to meet them. It says in verse 3 that this man lived in the burial caves and could no longer be restrained. Notice that phrase, he could no longer be restrained, even with a chain. Whenever he was put into chains and shackles, as he often was, notice that, as he often was, he snapped the chains and from his wrist and he smashed the shackles. No one was strong enough to subdue him. So the idea here, and I want you to picture the story with me, this man, I don't know at what point in his life, he took some wrong directions. He went away, he made some bad choices and some very bad choices and opened himself up to some other worse things. And eventually, bad decisions and bad choices and bad directions led to demonic influence and oppression and eventually demonic possession. And as we're going to see in a few minutes, not just any form of it, but a very severe form of it. And he is oppressed and he is in terrible shape. And as he got worse, according to the story we just read, you can understand that people at one time could control his rants. They could control his outbursts. They could subdue him. But eventually he got too strong that any one person could subdue him. For a while they could take him. When he was in one of his outbursts, they could actually chain him up and keep people safe from him until he calmed down. And then when they thought he was back to himself, they could let him go and say, "Are you okay now?" But eventually he got so much worse that when they would chain him up to try to keep him from harming himself or others, he was strong enough now to break the chains. to smash the shackles, and no one person could handle him. It got to the point where they basically said, just get out of town. Stay far away. And he was glad to do so. It says, verse 5, that day and night he wandered among the burial caves and in the hills, howling and cutting himself with sharp stones. If it wasn't a fearful story, if you didn't feel fearful reading it, you'd probably feel sad. What a life, what a sad place in life that he's cut off from society for everyone's sake. And he's just out there in this isolated area howling and cutting himself and is in miserable, miserable condition. And no one knows what to do. So everyone just stays away. And he stays away because he doesn't want to be chained up again, even if he can get loose. He doesn't want the conflict. They don't want the conflict. So he goes out there and lives out there, and they just learn to stay away. And that's what's going on. It says in verse number 6, when Jesus was still some distance away, the man saw him, ran to meet him, and he bowed low before him. With a shriek, he screamed, "Why are you interfering with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" So this is the demonic spirit talking through the man, shrieking out, "Why are you interfering with me?" And he identifies Jesus as the Son of the Most High God because he was the devils are under no disillusion about who Jesus is. People knew it, and some denied it, and some refused to believe it, but the devils knew, the demons knew, "You're the Son of the Most High God." And he then continues and says, "In the name of God, I beg you, don't torture me." Why would he say that? Because it says, for Jesus had already said to the spirit, "Come out of the man, you evil spirit." Now, it's interesting because Jesus is known for being able to say something and it's done. But Jesus told the evil spirit, "Come out of the man." And instead of the evil spirit coming out, it says here, it stayed a little longer. Not that it wasn't going to have to leave, but it stayed to beg him, "Please don't torture me." Here's what's interesting. It seems like when Jesus did miracles, there were just certain types of encounters he had that were a little harder to do. I just want to point that out. I don't know what that means, but Jesus sometimes did things and he would just speak the word and it was done. And there were other times where there's a little bit more going on. There's a time, many times, where he healed deaf ears or blind eyes. There's one story when he healed a blind man and it took a couple phases or stages before the man could fully see. Why was it more challenging that time? I don't know. Same with demonic forces that Jesus told his disciples. He said, he gave them the power, as we're going to see in an upcoming week. He gave them the authority and power to go out and in his name cast out devils, in his name heal the sick, using his name to do miracles. And they did, and they came back rejoicing at how easy it was that in his name even the evil spirits obeyed them. And yet, we also see scriptures where people tried to cast out an evil spirit using Jesus' name, and it did not go so well. There's one of those stories in Acts. There's one of those stories in Jesus' day when he comes off the Mount of Transfiguration, and a man has his son who's afflicted like this in front of his disciples who are down there, and it's a big ruckus because no one's able to do anything about it. And Jesus has to step in, and he explains afterwards, this kind only comes through prayer and fasting. It was almost like this whole, new devils, new levels type thinking of somehow some things aren't as easy as others to address. I don't know. But this man seems to have it going on because Jesus has told the evil spirit, "Come out of this man," and it's still there begging him, "Don't torture me." Then Jesus demanded, he said, "What is your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion," because there are many of us inside this man. That's creepy. Okay, let's just be real. That's messed up. There's many of us here. What does that mean? It seems like there's a lot of evil spirits in this man, and the one who's the mouthpiece, the leading voice, the spokesperson of all of them says, "My name is Legion, and here's why." Now, Legion's an interesting choice of names. It was a term that was used for a group of soldiers in those days. And the size of the groups of soldiers could vary depending on the army. But there's always, the Roman Empire had legions of soldiers, for example, and so did other groups. We understand that in today's term. If you look at the U.S. military, the army, for example, you say it's a squad of men, that'd be 12 soldiers. If you say there's a platoon, there'd be 40. If you say there's a company, that's 150. Or a battalion's even bigger, right? A legion, in those days, the number changed. People speculate that during the time of Jesus walking this earth, the Roman Empire called five or 6,000 people a legion. Later on, in the later parts of the Roman Empire, a legion was 1,000 people. So that number seemed to shift a couple times. Bottom line is that I don't think the number is important. I don't think he's trying to count how many. All I know is he's saying, look, there's a lot going on inside this man. My name is Legion. It's terrifying. It says in verse 10 that the evil spirits begged him again and again. Notice the ongoing conversation here. They begged him again and again not to send them to some distant place. I don't know what that means. I mean, I could speculate. It could mean that they don't want to leave the region. They don't want to go far away. They want to be in that where they are. Or it could mean something else. One of the other versions of the story in Matthew or Luke says that they said, don't send us off into the abyss, which some people believe means the depths of the ocean, the dark, helpless ocean. And others would say means some part of hell. But the bottom line is they're like, we don't want to go away. Honestly, the spirits seem to appreciate having a body to host them. And they don't want to be sent away with nowhere to go. And they're begging. And this is taking longer than it should take. Verse 11 says, there happened to be a large herd of pigs feeding on the hillside nearby. Not too far away, but far enough away. Send us into those pigs, the spirits begged. Let us enter them. That's going to bring a whole new flair to, you've heard of deviled eggs. Now we have demon ham, I guess, or something. I don't know. It's got a whole new conversation going on right here, right? And so they're like, hey, let's go into those pigs over there. And Jesus just wants this man to be free. He wants this child of God to be free. And so he says, fine. So Jesus gave them permission. The evil spirits came out of the man, and they entered the pigs. And the entire herd of about 2,000 pigs plunged down the steep hillside into the lake. The steep hillside could mean like a cliff, almost like a cliff, which is a very steep embankment. They stumbled down, went into, and drowned in the water. And you're like, oh, those poor pigs. Now, before you feel sorry for the pigs, I got some bad news for you. Some delicious news, but some bad news. They were probably short for this world at some point anyhow, right? They're probably being raised to be slaughtered and eaten. Let's just be real. So anyhow, they were not going to be, that's what the herd was for. However, it was a sad story for the poor people who owned the pigs, I suppose, because they'd like to probably sell them and slaughter them and sell them to the markets in their own time. I mean, all of a sudden, there's not a lack of ham in the area. Like, prices go down on pork for a while because we have plenty that we got to sell fast, and then we're in trouble when that's done. I mean, seriously, what a hit to some people. But whatever, this man is free. The pigs, I don't know if there's a demon for every pig or if just some of them, but either way, when they got in those pigs, the pigs went crazy, even in just a handful of them. I mean, the man, when they were inside the man, inside the man's body, they were able to use his human tendencies to talk words and communicate and think and correspond with other people. But in the pigs, they just went crazy and got scared and they just charged, and the whole herd, like a herd mentality, charged off and down into the lake, the Sea of Galilee, that Jesus just came off of, and they all drowned. Well, that's delicious. I mean, literally, no pun intended. And by the way, it's kind of weird for the demons too, right? They're like, we just want a body to host us, and then they end up drowning in the water, and they're in the abyss anyhow. That just didn't work out so well for them. But anyhow, it says in verse 14 that the herdsmen fled to the nearby town. Now, the herdsmen would be the people who were watching the pigs. That was their job. Their job was trying to keep them safe. They probably were trying to stop the stampede from happening once it started. Can you imagine? The herdsmen are probably not the owners, or it would say the owners. They're probably employees who are working for a very wealthy man who owns a lot of pigs, or a conglomerate of several pig owners who tag and put their pigs in the same herd while some company's business is to watch groups of pigs. I don't know how it worked. I wasn't there. Maybe some of you were. But I just know that these herdsmen, that was their job, and now the pigs, I mean, they probably had to keep themselves from going off the edge of the cliff trying to control the scene. And the pigs have drowned. And they're like, well, let's go back to town. And they told everybody. They told everyone on their way to town. And the word spread as they got to town. They spread the word in town. And look, no one else has anything going on. That would be newsworthy today. But back then, pre-Netflix, it was really like a spectacle. So people rushed out to see what had happened. And can you imagine the herdsmen? Can we just rewind the story for a minute and picture the whole story that we just told from their viewpoint? They're up there on this mount hill slash cliff side or whatever they're on, far enough away from the cemetery because they all know that that nutty man, that demon-possessed man is down there, so they just learn to stay away from him because you never know what's going on with him any given day. Just stay away. As they're up there doing their pig thing, they see a boat coming into the shore. They're thinking, uh-oh, the people in that boat are coming to a very bad spot to land. I hope they don't meet that guy. They don't know what they're walking into. And sure enough, they get off the boat, and there comes the man running towards them. They're like, oh boy, it's about to go down. And then they see the man falling in front of Jesus. They see Jesus have authority. They see an exorcism take place. They feel they're a safe distance away until all of a sudden the pigs go crazy. And then it gets real close and personal, and they rush into town and say, y'all need to know what just happened. And people come pouring out. It says, verse 15, a crowd soon gathered around Jesus, and they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons. He was sitting there, fully clothed and perfectly sane, and they were all afraid. They get to the scene, there's this person that showed up, Jesus and his entourage, and there's a man that they've known all too well, that they've been frightened by, but suddenly he's not frightening anymore. He's sitting there. He's fully clothed, which means Jesus or somebody in his group had a change of clothes and said, here, put these on. And he's fully clothed. And he's in his right mind. And they've not seen that before in a long time. And it says, and they were all afraid. Say, why would they be afraid? They should have been afraid before. Why would they be afraid now? I think it's the same way that the disciples were afraid in the boat in the middle of the storm, right? When they were in the water. Remember how they were afraid of the storm trying to stay alive? And when Jesus said, peace be still, and calmed it, it's as they were afraid of him saying, what kind of person can speak to the wind and waves and calm them? There's a different kind of fear. Not like a, he's going to hurt me, but kind of an awe. And here these people are looking at this man who no one could control all that time. No one, they couldn't help him. They've tried. They tried to control him. They couldn't do that either. They're like, just stay away. Hide your kids, hide your wives, and hide your husbands. Stay away from the burial caves. It is dangerous over there for you to meander. And they're far away. And now this man's fine. And that freaks them out a little bit. It says in verse 16, then those who had seen what had happened, the herdsmen probably, those who had seen what had happened, told the others about the demon-possessed man and the pigs. By the way, we were talking about this after church. I was wondering at last service, I was thinking they have a surplus of food, you know, but do they? I'm wondering if anyone wanted to, like, I'm not eating those pigs. I don't want, you know, ooh, whatever it was in that man with those pigs, I don't want to eat that food because they might bring it into my house. Who knows how superstitious they were or afraid they were. So it's a real tragedy if the pigs are lost and the food is lost, I guess. It says that when they told everyone what happened, verse 17, and the crowd began pleading with Jesus to go away and leave them alone. Isn't that an interesting reaction? Why? Why tell them to go away? Well, we saw why. They were afraid. I mean, let's be honest. Jesus has just disrupted things. I mean, I would think that they would say to Jesus, come into town, my friend. Dinner is on us. It's ham, okay? Dinner's on us. Come into town. Come into town. If you could do that for this man that we couldn't help, then you could help some other people as well that we know. Or if you could help someone like that, then we want to hear what you have to say. Why would they not just welcome him into town? And they didn't because they were afraid. He was a disruptor. You see, I know the man was crazy and they should have been afraid of him. They were afraid of him. But that man that lived in the tombs, as bad as that was their normal. We know what that's like, don't we? We have bad things in our lives that we're not fond of, we don't like, but we're used to it. We manage it. It's our normal, and we don't like it, but we just learn to deal with it. And that man was something that they learned to deal with. But then Jesus shows up. He's disruptive. And this man is completely healed in a way that no one could ever do before. Like, how is that possible? And the pigs, they're probably looking out in the water, watching a bunch of bodies of pigs floating on top of the water. They're like, what just happened? They're like, we want you to go away. If showing up for a few hours on our shore causes all that to happen, what would 2 weeks of you being in our area do? We don't need any more of that stuff, okay? Just give us all a break and just please, thank you, but take your show somewhere else. And here's the thing about Jesus. He was willing to oblige their wishes because he would never go where he was not wanted. He told his disciples the same thing. They don't want you to shake the dust off your feet. Just don't, if you're not wanted, just go away. That's how God works in all of our lives, by the way. That God loves you so much, but he won't force himself on any of us. If you draw near to him, he'll draw near to us. He's right there. He wants it. Hebrews 11:6 tells us about faith, that faith is believing that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him, that God wants a connection, but like any loving person, it's not forced upon you. He can help us. He can hear us. He can walk with us, but he will not impose himself. And so it's up to you if you want a relationship with him. And here's Jesus being told, we don't want you here. And Jesus says, okay, then I'll go. Guys, let's get back into the boat. Verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Can you picture this guy? He's like, listen, I don't know where to go from here. I don't want to live in these tombs anymore. That's been lousy. I don't know where I can go back to. I don't really want to face any. Can I just go with you? Can I just like go be with you? Because I wish you were still here, but if you got to leave, can I take me with you, please? But Jesus said no. Wait a minute. Jesus said no. When does Jesus ever say no? I mean, Jesus always let people follow him, didn't he? I mean, Jesus once called fishermen to leave their fishing nets and follow him, and they did. He once called a tax collector, Matthew, leave your occupation and follow me, and he did. Jesus had dozens of people following him, men and women. We'll see some of their names in an upcoming week. Men and women who followed him everywhere. He had a group of people that were called disreputable sinners, who he ate with and feasted with, and then a bunch of them became part of his entourage, according to Mark. And the religious folks didn't like, they're like, those people shouldn't be in your group. They're not the right kind of people to be in a serious group like this if you're the Messiah. Jesus says, come along. But this man wants to come, and Jesus says, no. Why? It says, but Jesus said, no, go home to your family. Makes me think about, what was this man's family? Did he have a mom and dad still who watched him in his life take a bunch of series of decisions that broke their hearts, and they spoke where they could and they restrained where they needed to and just prayed a lot and lost a lot of sleep as his life spun worse and worse out of control? Did they lose sleep at night and carry tremendous heartache throughout their years? Did they have shame in town as being the parents of the guy who's demon-possessed and a problem for the whole community? I don't know. Jesus said, go home. They need to see the difference that God has made. Does he have a wife? I don't know. If so, what prospects does she have in that culture as a woman if he goes like this? In general, let alone if, you know, she's the reputation of the woman who's, you know, she probably drove him crazy, you know? I mean, who knows what she was dealing with? What's she going to do? She destitute? Is she struggling? Does she have kids? Do other kids say, oh, your dad's the crazy one? Do they have less stuff because dad's not there to help provide? I don't know what's going on, but Jesus says, go home to your family, because here's the thing. You can come with me, but I care about your family, because for all of us, we need to remember that God cares as Jesus followers. He wants us to care about those closest to us. He wants us to care about the people we call family. And so, go home to your family. And then he says this, go home to your family and tell them everything the Lord has done for you and how merciful he has been. And this is cool because as you're going to see in a moment, it wasn't just the family. This went beyond the family. Like tell people everywhere, everyone, about everything that Jesus has done, the Lord has done for you and how merciful he has been. Why? Because Jesus wasn't welcome to stay there. Jesus is like, I can't go tell them. They've asked me to leave. If you come with me, then who's going to tell them? I got to go, but you can stay. So you go tell them for me. You know, in a lot of ways, this right here is a microcosm of the whole ministry of Jesus. Picture the whole ministry of Jesus in the same light. That Jesus came into this world to help and to save us all and to do a lot of good along the way. And boy, when Jesus came into this world for his whole ministry, he was a disruptor, wasn't he? He disrupted a lot. But he came to his own, John once said, and his own did not receive him. They rejected him. Isaiah once prophesied that he was a man who was despised and rejected by everyone. He came into this world, he did a lot of good. Many people loved it, but the powers that be and the religious leaders did not like it. And eventually they stirred the multitudes up against Jesus until one fateful Passover, they were yelling, crucify him, crucify him. As Jesus said they would do, way before it happened. And then he died and he rose again, as Jesus said he would do. And he stayed around for a few weeks to get his team mobilized to carry on, but he was on his way out. He said, they've rejected me. One of the things they yelled is, we have no king but Caesar, which they didn't even believe. They were just rejecting him. And Jesus said, I've got to go. And when he told his disciples, I've got to go, the scriptures tell us that they were upset. They wanted to go with him. Same story. But Jesus said, no. I'm going to go prepare a place for you. You stay here and carry on telling everyone everything I've done for you and what I've come to do for the whole world. Spread the message. And they did. What, ultimately, that's our all call, all of our calling. This is almost the beginning of the great commission that Jesus is going to give. This is a micro picture of the commission God gave all of us. He says, I'm going away. You stay here and spread the word. Think about this for a minute. If I can challenge your thinking, why does God leave us here once we become believers? Why not the minute we become believers, why not just take us out of here and take us to heaven? I know that for us, that's like, I don't want to go. That's scary, for one. Transitions, yikes. And also, I love what I have here, or sometimes I do at least, you know. But why not take us there? In the long run, we either know this or we will know this. We're better off there. Where there's no more sickness, and no more death, and no more heartache, and no more drama, and no more hurting each other, and no more temptations, and no more mess. Why not take us there? Say, well, I'm here so I can read my Bible and pray. How much better could you communicate with Jesus face to face? I think you'd do a better job there. Oh, I'm here so I can worship him. I think we could worship him better face to face, don't you? I just think it would go better that way. So, well, I'm here so I can live a righteous life. How are we doing with that? I mean, with all the sin and temptation and struggles around us, how much better could we do in Jesus' presence? There's one thing we can only do here. We can tell everybody all that Jesus has done. We can be a witness. You see, Jesus says, spread the gospel, or gospel means good news. Tell everybody. We saw a few weeks ago, we talked about how that we are ambassadors for Christ, that ambassador is someone who is not in his home country. He's in another place, but he's working. He's not lazy, hiding out and locking behind closed doors. He's actively making a difference and an impact for the kingdom he represents where he's at and where she is at. And an ambassador does that until their time is up. And we are here to spread the word, to bring the kingdom of God to people and bring people to God and to say, listen, here's what he's done. And this story is a microcosm of all of that. That's the biggest reason. That's the one thing we can do here. We could not do better in the presence of God. He says, the world has asked, I stepped into this world. They didn't all receive me. I did my job. I've left. You go take the message everywhere about what I've done. You know who understood this concept really well? Is the Apostle Paul. I'm jumping all over the place, but bear with me. The Apostle Paul, 20-some years later, would serve the Lord, and he was in prison, getting ready to be potentially executed, gonna die. And he's writing a letter to one of the churches that he's helped to found, and in his letter he said, I am torn between two separate desires. On one end, I kind of want them to just to kill me so I can die and go be with Jesus. He said, that one is far better for me. It's better for me to just leave this world and be with Jesus. That's my personal win. But on the other hand, he said, I feel like you need me to be here still, and I don't want to let you down, so I'm torn to stay here and do the work I can still do for you. I'm torn two ways. And there's things that we can do here that we can only do here. And one of the things that God has called us to do is to represent him in this world. And so he tells this man in the story, look, you can come with me, but I want you to stay here and go back to the place that I am leaving by request and tell them everything that I've done and spread the good news. Verse 20 says this, so the man started off to visit the 10 towns of that region, and he began to proclaim the great things that Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed at what he told them. The 10 towns, I don't know if he had family in all 10 towns or this went well beyond his family. He probably didn't live right next to the town his family was mostly in. Probably best to stay away from them. I don't know where they were. But he went all over the place. People who knew him everywhere, knew about him everywhere. And he began to spread the word. And it says, everyone is amazed. Wouldn't they be amazed at what Jesus had done for him? I want to give you two statements, one question, and we'll be done. That's the story. Two statements, one question. Here's the first one. There are people that you are uniquely positioned to reach for Jesus. In today's story, Jesus is like, they want me to leave. You don't have to leave. If you leave, who's going to tell them? So stay here. Otherwise, they'll never know. So stay here. And that's true for all of us in life. There are people you are uniquely positioned because of your personality, because of your job, because of your family, because of your, you know, friend circles or your hobbies, who you are and where you are in life. You're uniquely positioned. And you might think, oh, I wish I could hear this one person, you know, talk to them that I respect because they could really bring, you know, some truth about God into their lives. I wish that the people in my life could hear you, Arlen, get to know you and hear from you, or hear some better communicator 1,000 places around that I look up to who could come and really help them, because I don't think I can. But that's just not true. There are a lot of people, not everyone resonates with everybody else. There are a ton of people that I just don't click with them. They don't resonate. I don't resonate with them. I know that's a shock, right? That's just hard to imagine that to be true. But there's just some people. But you do. You could bring your favorite influencer in the world in. You know, the most powerful people that you respect are both loved and hated by other people. Not everyone is everyone's cup of tea. But the people in your orbit are people who know you, who've gotten to know you. You're not a stranger anymore. Their guard is let down. They know you better. You have influence, and you're uniquely positioned to make an impact in their lives that not anyone else that you think has a bigger circle or sphere of influence. Those people can't reach yours the way that you can. There are people that you are uniquely positioned to reach for Jesus. You say, yeah, but how? What would I say? I don't have a great theological, you know, background. I don't know how to debate hard issues. I got news for you. There's a lot of people who say they can, who are, you know, speaking more confidently than they should be. What's the point of debating things anyhow? You know, here's my second statement. A changed life is the most powerful witness. On the screen here. A changed life is the most powerful witness. That's true. It's the power of story. It's the power of story. That I can get up here and I can tell you, I can teach an ideology, and you can resist and we can argue, but it's hard. Story is so powerful. Story comes through in it, and it brings truth in a softer punch. That you can go to people and you can argue all you want to, it might make a difference, but you know what no one can argue with? They can't argue with your story. That's your story. And a changed life is the most powerful witness. Think about the story today as we get ready to wrap up. Think about the story today. Imagine if that man had been healed by Jesus, had gotten into the boat, and sailed away. What would the town remember? Can you picture them a couple years later? Hey, whatever happened to that guy? He was scary. I'll tell you what. Yeah, I don't know. I heard some guy showed up and helped him. And we've all heard 10 versions of that, so I don't know which one's true. But some guy showed up to help him. I hear he helped the guy and did something that's powerful. I think the guy went with him and left. Well, I hope he really is helped, or that guy's going to be in trouble. Oh, well, not our problem anymore. The end. But because he showed up and lived there, his family got to see him day by day. People saw him work and provide as a man for himself and his family. People saw him go into the marketplace and do business. And he's a whole different person than he ever was before. They're going to ask him at what point, what happened? Or he's just going to tell them without being asked. And as the years go by, that story is going to permeate a culture, because a changed life is the most powerful witness. Which brings me to my question today. What has Jesus done for you? What has Jesus done for you? Has he set you free from addiction? Has he restored a relationship that you've lost? Did you have some bad relationships before you knew him? And then when he got a hold of your life, you got a whole new opportunity and new relationships that are thriving, and you're a whole different person. Like, what's the change? Jesus is the change. Were you raised in a world by the grace of God to where you avoided some of the heartache and tragic messiness of a life without Jesus that some people knew since they were born, and you've been protected from so much and had such a better foundation because you were given that through the message of Jesus and the grace of God? Have you been set free from anxiety, depression, struggles that we sang about earlier? Have you found in your life that before you weren't sure what was the point of life, but suddenly you see there's purpose and there's meaning to life, and there's a task for me to do, and there's something for me to rally around that's given your life direction and depth? And I hate to even start listing things because I'm going to miss the one that fits you. So forget my words and let me just ask you, what has Jesus done for you? And here's my advice. Here's my challenge. Tell someone else. That's it. Tell someone else. Why else are we here? Everything we could do could be so much better unless we're representing the kingdom of God. We can live and die. We can live a short life. We can live a long life. One day we're going to leave it behind. And as by faith we believe that a better day awaits us. But while we're here, we can represent, we can spread the good news. So what has Jesus done for you? Tell someone. Because a changed life is the most powerful witness. It's better than anything I would say to someone in your orbit. And you, there are people that you are uniquely positioned to reach for Jesus. So I ask you, what has Jesus done for you? And I challenge you to tell someone else.